it is put to cripple Palestinian civil society.
Mariam, can you explain who is the Jenin Brigade? What's their role in Jenin versus the security forces affiliated with the Palestinian Authority?
Right. So in Jenin refugee camp, to what the military, Israeli military dubs as the wasp's nest, we have seen a rise of Palestinian armed youth groups starting within 2021 until today. And these are small battalions. These are youth that grew up in the camp. Many of them have been imprisoned by Israel under administrative detention, meaning no trial, no charge, only torture. And they decided to take up arms, essentially, because they found that across the last decade, any efforts of Palestinians, whether it is in negotiations or whether it is in unarmed and nonviolent confrontation, has only allowed Israel to continue its expansion of settlements on Palestinian lands and continue its escalation of violence on Palestinians. So they see themselves as the force that is trying to push back. Even though they're limited in resources, they are protecting their homes. And please remember that these are the refugees that essentially Israel and its militia, its Zionist militias, had kicked out of their original homes in 1948 that are located within heartland Palestine, or what is now Israel. The difference between them and the Palestinian Authority is that the Palestinian Authority, which has been given the role of an administrative role under the Oslo Accord,
we just have 15 seconds,
has actually done nothing. Has done nothing to protect Palestinians, and actually during the siege remained within the headquarters, letting Palestinian families just being bombed constantly throughout the siege.
Mariam Barghouti, Palestinian writer and journalist, will link to your piece for 972 magazine, Inside the Brutal Siege of Jenin, part two, online at democracynow.org, when we ask her what it's like to be a journalist reporting on Jenin.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kabu.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Go to kabu.fm/wakeup to support KABU during our Wake Up the Neighborhood fall membership drive by grabbing limited edition KABU merch. You can support local community radio in style with your choice of t-shirt and hoodies in pavement black, snow white, oregano green, cherry red, and sandy beach. That's kabu.fm/wakeup to get yours before they're gone.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Support for KABU comes from our members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located on 8th Avenue and Burnside in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.org. Special thanks to the recent donors to our fall fund drive. Thank you to Susan B., Nancy G., and Stephen W. Be like these nice people and donate at kabu.fm/give. Now, your KABU Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on this special membership drive edition of the KABU Evening News, Portland police published their first body-worn camera footage after an officer shot and injured a Portlander.
A top administrator at Multnomah County resigns.
And later, we speak with the author of the new study, Drug Decriminalization, Fentanyl, and Fatal Overdoses in Oregon.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Monday, September 9th, 2024. KABU is currently in our fall membership drive, and we'd like to encourage you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Eliza Yurkov.
And I'm Reed Johnson. Portland police released the identity of the officer who shot and injured a man on August 24th. Officer Nicholas Morales shot and wounded 52-year-old Robert Seeger in the Portsmouth neighborhood. It's the first case where Portland police have body camera footage of the shooting. The video is mainly obscured by the patrol car Morales was in and doesn't show what led up to Morales opening fire. Here's what, according to police, led up to the incident. Police responded to calls of an armed man acting erratically and found Seeger with a handgun and having picked up a hammer. Officers shot at him with a 40-millimeter less lethal round and then with a regular gun. Officers say that he continued to disobey their commands even after being shot, so they released a canine on him before arresting him. He was then taken to the hospital and later booked at Multnomah County Detention Center. Seeger was charged with unlawful use of a weapon, felony in possession of a firearm, burglary, and menacing. Officer Nicholas Morales, who shot Seeger, is on paid administrative leave while the Bureau conducts an internal review. The issue will go to a grand jury to determine if Morales was justified in opening fire. Up to 24 officers witnessed the shooting, according to a police bureau spokesperson.
Multnomah County's Chief Operating Officer, Serena Cruz, is resigning. Her last day will be September 20th. Cruz is one of County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson's top deputies. The reasons for her resignation remain unknown. Vega Peterson thanked Cruz in an email to county staff, writing, quote, "I am grateful for Serena's leadership at the county through COVID and in the rebuilding years that followed. As COO, she helped stabilize our organization after COVID-19 disruptions and our transition to a hybrid workforce. She recruited and hired talented department directors, grew our response to severe weather emergencies, built out our first dedicated security team, and tackled contract administration issues that have helped our county stay accountable," end quote. Vega Peterson named Cruz's deputy, Travis Graves, as interim COO. Cruz was the youngest woman ever elected to Multnomah County government when she won a seat as District 2 Commissioner in 1999. She served in this role until 2006, representing North and Northeast Portland. She was named County COO in 2021 by former County Chair Deborah Cafori. The county has hired Carass Consulting to lead the search for Cruz's replacement. Carass Consulting is the same firm which hired Cruz in 2021.
In further local news, the City of Portland is centralizing its community grant process. City Council adopted a grant management policy on September 4th. It will require all city grants from the general fund to go through a centralized online portal called Web Grants. The portal should go live next summer and will offer access to potential grantees, as well as anyone interested in seeing where grant money goes. The move is significant as the city allocates more and more general fund dollars for grants. In the 2018-2019 fiscal year, the city distributed $6.4 million in grants from the general fund. By 2022, the figure had more than doubled to $16.6 million. All told, from 2018 to 2023, the city gave out more than $52 million in grants, mostly to nonprofits. Efforts to centralize the grant process will be a tandem effort between the Office of Community and Civic Life and the Office of Management and Finance. The city hopes to accomplish a, quote, comprehensive process and transparency framework for its community grants. Commissioner Dan Ryan introduced the plan for the grant administration policy at a city council meeting late last month, calling it, quote, basic housekeeping and fundamental accountability, end quote. General fund allocations represent only a small fraction of the city's grant funds. A vast majority from the 2022-2023 fiscal year were restricted Portland Clean Energy Fund grants, grants from the Portland Children's Levy, and subawards from state and federal grant programs. Those grants already fall under comprehensive grant tracking and accountability processes.
Funding is coming to a program that supports students from low-income families in Washington State who want to go on to college or post-secondary education. The Gear Up program has received a $35 million grant from the U.S. Department of Education for the next 7 years of operation. Gear Up stands for Gaining Early Awareness and Readiness for Undergraduate Programs. Marcy Mills is the Gear Up director with the Washington Student Achievement Council.
when you come from a low-income family or a family that doesn't have that college-going experience, navigating that process can be really difficult. So the desire is there, the interest is there, but they won't necessarily know or understand the steps that it takes to achieve that.
Gear Up has been in operation since 1999. It supports students starting in seventh grade through their first year of post-secondary education. The program helps about 6,800 students each year, according to the Washington Student Achievement Council. Eligible students can receive up to $800 in scholarships. Mills says the program provides a range of services, and her office has found which services have the greatest impact.
We provide college visits. We include family members in that whenever possible. We provide a lot of workshops during the school day. We definitely provide financial aid, information, and counseling to students and families.
Mills says Gear Up is focusing on 13 rural school districts with funding to hire staff who work with students and families. She says her program will provide technical support.
Our small rural districts really are so under-resourced compared to the larger districts who also have needs. But in comparison, quite often a rural school might not even have a full-time counselor.
That was Marcy Mills, director of Gear Up in Washington.
Today is the first day that the all-new Homeless Policy Oversight Board will meet, as appointed by Multnomah County and Portland. They're tasked with overseeing policy and budget decisions, but two chairs on the new oversight board will sit empty. That's because Portland City Council created two hyper-specific seats that it is yet to fill. One is reserved for a wealthy Multnomah County resident who pays the Metro Supportive Services tax but doesn't live in Portland. The other is reserved for a behavioral health practitioner who comes from an organization that doesn't have any contracts with the city or county. An advisor told Multnomah County commissioners last week that they couldn't find enough candidates who qualify for those specific seats. 14 people applied to the two seats, but the advisor says they were disqualified by some of the specifics. The two seats are non-voting members, so the committee can start without them. But the makeup and work of the board is still precarious. Portland City councilors pushed hard for those positions to be included. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler and Commissioner Dan Ryan say they're looking for candidates to fill the seats themselves. The new contract with the Joint Office of Homeless Services says the county must produce certain results by October 15th, or Portland could exit the partnership.
New polling shows Harris struggles with male voters, while Trump faces challenges with female voters. Tomorrow's presidential debate is important with the race tight. And a New Hampshire candidate is under fire for ties to a big corporate landlord. With more on the story, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I believe that I am the best person to do this job at this moment, for all Americans, regardless of race and gender.
The momentum Democratic Vice President Kamala Harris has been riding since stepping into the presidential race may be fading. A new CNN poll shows the first woman of color nominated by a major party has a challenge with men in a crucial state, down 15%, with likely male voters in Pennsylvania. The flip side of that gender divide shows former President Donald Trump is down 11% with likely female voters there. But Trump also faces questions within the Republican Party. Former South Carolina governor and fierce Trump primary opponent Nikki Haley was asked about his recent remarks mocking sexual assault allegations against him. The former UN ambassador said she endorsed her old boss for his policies, not his persona.
Do I agree with his style? Do I agree with his approach? Do I agree with his communications? No.
During the interview with CBS, Haley said both Trump and Harris have a record, and neither is perfect or ideal. Former Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney and her father, former Vice President Dick Cheney, have both said they plan to vote for Harris. Liz Cheney says she's still a conservative but won't vote for Trump because he's a threat to American democracy. Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders says it won't matter.
You look across the board, prominent Republicans are supporting President Trump, but ultimately, I think she's a non-factor.
Tomorrow night's debate could be crucial in the close contest. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg says Harris has a tough job. Make people feel comfortable with her vision for the country while fending off Trump's famously personal attacks.
She is a very focused and disciplined leader, but it will take almost superhuman focus and discipline to deal with Donald Trump in a debate. It's no ordinary proposition.
Press reports say former Senator Kelly Ayotte, now a Republican candidate for governor of New Hampshire, made millions through a private equity firm, profiting from the housing crisis. State Senator Rebecca Perkins Cuoca says Ayotte made money when equity firm Blackstone bought properties only to increase prices and force tenants out.
You know, we do see this corporate investment in single-family homes affecting the availability not just of homes to buy, but also of homes to rent.
Polls show the housing crisis is the top concern among New Hampshire voters. Research from two California colleges finds voters in local races are still open to choosing a candidate from the opposite party if they agreed on an important regional issue. Sacramento State Associate Professor Danielle Martin co-authored the study.
Overall, voters do support candidates from their own party, even when an opposite party candidate was closer to their views. But we also found that about 40% defected from their party.
National Voter Registration Day is a week from Tuesday. Nonpartisan groups like the League of Women Voters say it's a reminder to make sure your registration is still good. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $30,000 by September 21st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on a new study from the Journal of the American Medical Association called Drug Decriminalization, Fentanyl, and Fatal Overdoses in Oregon. At 6 p.m., it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. And then at 7, KBOO presents Running on Air, the daily radio roundtable conversation with the people running to represent Portland. On this episode, we'll speak with candidates from District 1, Terrence Hayes, Steph Ruth, and Dion Salazar. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 59 degrees. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy with a high of 76. Today in history, in 1947, the first ever computer bug was found. It might be not what you're thinking of. A moth got lodged in the switch in the Harvard Mark II computer at Harvard University. The quote of the day is from Russian author Leo Tolstoy, born this day in 1828. He wrote, quote, "The most difficult subjects can be explained to the most slow-witted man if he has not formed any idea of them already. But the simplest thing cannot be made clear to the most intelligent man if he is firmly persuaded that he knows already, without a shadow of doubt, what is laid before him."
This weekend, the Grand Chief of the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs, Kathy Merrick, died suddenly. Indigenous leaders across Canada are remembering her life and advocacy. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Condolences have been pouring in over the weekend after the sudden death of a senior Native leader in Manitoba. Kathy Merrick was the Grand Chief of the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, she collapsed outside a courthouse on Friday.
Police and those on the scene performed emergency care before she was taken to hospital. The Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs confirmed her death in a statement and said it would honor Merrick's legacy and continue her work. In 2022, Kathy Merrick became the first female chief in the history of the organization, and then she was re-elected in July. On Saturday, Indigenous leaders came together to mourn her loss. Here's Pimichikamak Cree Nation Chief David Monias.
She leaves a big footprint in our hearts in Manitoba, especially in Indigenous communities across Manitoba and across Canada.
Merrick was described as a tireless advocate for Indigenous health care and for missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Premier Wab Kadoo says she was instrumental in calling on the Manitoba government to conduct a search of a landfill for the remains of two Indigenous women.
And so when we think about the legacy that she leaves behind in calling all of us to work together as one province to make this a place where we live up to that phrase that we're going to honor in a few weeks' time, where every child matters, that is why I say that she was our Grand Chief, chosen by the chiefs, but a servant of all people from all backgrounds.
Merrick was also remembered for her positive attitude and guidance. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau described her as a relentless and effective advocate for First Nations people, especially those most vulnerable, and a leader that inspired so many. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The death of a Rapid City, South Dakota teenager has broken hearts across the Native community as members of the community seek change. Many attendees of a recent candlelight vigil asked for one thing, an end to gun violence. South Dakota Public Broadcasting CJ Keene has more.
Xavier White Whirlwind was shot in the head on East Fairlane Drive between Ivy Avenue and Elm Street on Monday, September 2nd. The 13-year-old died later in the hospital. Dominic Stans is Xavier's father.
His little spirit, he had a free spirit. He wasn't afraid to get into anything or try anything new.
Brave.
Yeah, he had a lot of courage and braveness. No fear, he's happy.
As candles burn in the night for Stans' son, parents clutch their children. Coursing through the event is a plea to the next generation to avoid the cycles of drug abuse and gang violence that creates the need for these vigils. That includes Waylon Stans, who helped raise Xavier.
There's only two ways out. What are they?
Death and jail.
We don't want that no more. They don't want us empowering ourselves, educating ourselves. We have the power. It's gotta stop.
After sharing sage, prayers, and tears, the family and community shared in song. The Rapid City Police Department has two persons of interest in the case. An anonymous tip can be submitted by texting the letters RCPD and the information to 847-411. For National Native News, I'm CJ Keene in Rapid City.
The University of Arizona College of Nursing has received a federal grant to help support Indigenous students pursuing nursing careers. The more than $1 million grant from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services will fund the Indians in Nursing program for 5 more years. The program provides Indigenous students financial support for tuition fees and a living stipend. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Last week at the Straits of Mackinac, Indigenous water protectors and their allies highlighted the critical dangers of the 71-year-old Line 5, labeled as North America's most dangerous crude oil pipeline. Crystal Blair has more about the event.
Indigenous water protectors and allies met at Michigan's Straits of Mackinac last week to spotlight the dangers of the 71-year-old Line 5, deemed North America's riskiest crude oil pipeline. Headlined by the nonprofit Oil and Water Don't Mix, the protest featured two main events, the Pipe Out Paddle Up in St. Ignace, which showcased a flotilla against Enbridge's Line 5 oil spill risk, followed by the Water is Life Festival in Petoskey, celebrating local music and advocacy for ending Line 5's threat. Dr. Nicole Kiway-Biber is with Clean Water Action. She explains that Indigenous people have been given stewardship over the waters.
But also really critical to us having lived relationship to our culture and what our teachings are and our instructions are. And so much of that is to protect and oversee the water and the wildlife.
Kiway-Biber says that the events emphasize the preservation of the Indigenous way of life. Enbridge maintains that Line 5 safety is exclusively regulated by the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. Kiway-Biber highlights that there are many individuals, both from Michigan and beyond, who treasure and deeply value the Great Lakes, but remain unaware of the significant threats posed by Line 5.
They may not know we're constantly just a moment away from this catastrophic kind of ruination of those precious freshwaters. And, you know, it's powerful for them to first and foremost hear about it from people who are committed to protecting the water and the people and the wildlife.
Enbridge moves up to 540,000 barrels of light crude oil, light synthetic oil, and NGL through Line 5. For the Michigan News Connection, I'm Crystal Blair.
A common narrative suggests that deeply polarized American voters always support their party's candidates, but a new study suggests otherwise in certain circumstances. Researchers from Sacramento State and San Diego State Universities asked more than 900 partisan voters about housing and homelessness. They asked them to choose, in a hypothetical local election, between a candidate from their party who disagreed with their views or one from the opposite party who is aligned with them on policy. Sacramento State Associate Professor Danielle Martin co-authored the study.
Overall, voters do support candidates from their own party, even when an opposite party candidate was closer to their views. But we also found that about 40% defected from their party. So instead of picking the co-partisan candidate, they picked the candidate that aligned with their preferences on one of those local issues.
The study found that people with weak party loyalty were more likely to defect, as were people who are very invested in their policy position. They also found that in national and state level races, people are much less likely to split their votes between parties. Study co-author Professor Ted Lasher, also from Sacramento State, says the data shows that voters are more flexible when an issue hits close to home.
Somebody who's running, who's the out party in terms of local party identification, may be able to win elections in city council and mayoral races if they choose the issue very carefully, because voters will sometimes cross party lines on particular local issues.
San Diego State University political science professor Brian Adams says this means that even though Democrats enjoy broad support in California, that support is more conditional than absolute in local races.
What a lot of this research suggests is that if Republicans put forward candidates that actually agreed with some of the policy positions that Democratic voters have, at least some Democratic voters would be willing to switch.
About 96% of electoral contests in the U.S. are at the local level for races such as the school board, the city council, and the county board of commissioners.
In Idaho, an initiative that would get rid of closed party primaries and create a ranked choice system has cleared its final legal hurdle to go on November's ballot. A district court judge dismissed the attorney general's challenge. Eric Tagetoff reports.
A proposal to end closed party primaries and use a ranked choice system will appear on the November ballot. With less than 2 months to the election, a district court judge has dismissed a challenge from Idaho Attorney General Raul Labrador to keep Proposition 1 off the ballot. The initiative would end the state's closed party primaries and implement a ranked choice voting system. Labrador argues signature gatherers misled the public on the nature of the initiative. In August, the state Supreme Court dismissed a similar claim from the Attorney General. Margaret Kinzel with Mormon Women for Ethical Government and Idahoans for Open Primaries says Labrador has failed to prove his case.
We are gratified that the system worked and that the Citizens Ballot Initiative process has been protected.
Kinzel says the organizations she's affiliated with have continued doing outreach despite the challenges to Proposition 1. In response to the district court ruling, Labrador says it's up to voters whether to approve an expensive ranked choice voting system that has resulted in confusion in other states. Kinzel says the initiative will allow about 270,000 independent voters, not affiliated with either major party, to participate in consequential primary elections.
They currently cannot vote in the taxpayer-funded primary elections, particularly the Republican primary election in May, and that is where most races are decided because we have such a strong Republican majority in the state.
Supporters have said opponents to Proposition 1 have exaggerated costs for implementing the initiative. Kinzel also pushes back on the idea that the top four ranked choice voting system is confusing.
We really do ranked choice voting all the time. We send somebody to the grocery store and say, buy the apple pie. If they don't have apple, get blueberry. And so it really is this idea of we express our preference. If that preference is not available, we move on to our second preference.
The general election takes place on November 5th. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tagetoff.
You are listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 9th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes myself and Doug McVeigh. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Eric Tagedoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Crystal Blair, Suzanne Potter, and Alex Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, so now is a great time to join. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. KBOO's Doug McVeigh speaks with the author of the study Drug Decriminalization, Fentanyl, and Fatal Overdoses in Oregon.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
A new article entitled Drug Decriminalization, Fentanyl, and Fatal Overdoses in Oregon was published September 5th in the American Medical Association's journal JAMA Network Open. It shows that the recent rise in overdose deaths in Oregon was not related to the decriminalization of possession of some drugs, but rather to the introduction of fentanyl to the drug market. To learn more, I spoke with the lead author, Michael Zurab, PhD.
My name is Michael Zurab. I'm a data scientist in New York City. I also am a consultant at Rhode Island Hospital doing research related to substance use epidemiology.
I've asked you on to talk about a new article of which your lead author entitled Drug Decriminalization, Fentanyl, and Fatal Overdoses in Oregon, which was published September 5th in the journal JAMA Network Open. Let's start from the top. What led you to look at the relationship between criminalization of people who use drugs and deaths due to a toxic, unregulated drug supply and drug overdose?
Yeah, I guess there's like a broad answer and a specific answer. The broad answer is that, as we all know, there's a big overdose crisis in the United States, and the sort of primary policy regime has been criminalization in the United States for many decades.